When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS, and with me, hooray, back from a protracted period of land agency, is the effortlessly feudal Thea
Leonarduzzi. I put a lot of effort into being so feudal. Yeah. It's taken me 4 months to be so feudal.
Has anyone ever called you feudal before?
No.
Do you feel feudal? Now you're a landowner?
Yes, now I preside over vast swathes of Sussex.
Yeah, vast tracts of land. But you're back.
I am back.
You're now commuting from Sussex.
I am.
And you're enjoying it.
I am. Day two.
Day two. It's all going
brilliant.
Well.
Yes,
you do seem really happy. Maybe because for 2 weeks of buying a house, you were absolutely wretchedly miserable.
Yes.
And we don't need to spend. We were going to spend the podcast slagging off estate agents, but we don't need to do that now.
Yeah, we can just file it away as something that has done, it's run its course, and now I'm there. I should say I do not own vast tracts of land. No. I own a small house.
No one takes what we say in this podcast either literally or seriously. I'm almost positive. If you want to subscribe to the TLS, Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the show this week, was Matthew Arnold any good as a poet? A provocative question asked and answered this week by Seamus Perry, who thinks that Arnold was pretty good even when he was being deliberately bad. A paradox he shall explain later. Transgender people are immediately often treated as instant experts in their own field. People, according to Stephanie Burt, may come up and ask you to teach them Trans 101 while you are still learning who you are and how you got there and who you can now try to be. Stephanie will be on hand to say what books by trans people can help in the general education process. And Thea has been speaking to the wonderful Mexican novelist Valeria Luiselli. Go on, how'd you do it?
Valeria Luiselli.
About her book Tell Me How It Ends, an account of life in New York's immigration courts, and her own memoir of being a Mexican woman in the United States. We shall have a chunk of that interview now, and the whole interview will be played as a special podcast too.
The Mexican-American relationship has been much in the news recently, mostly via discussion of illegal aliens, of the building of vast and expensive walls, of instant deportations, of dreamers being abruptly woken up. But what stories are not being told, either enough or at all? In 2014, an unprecedented rise in the number of unaccompanied and undocumented Mexican and Central American children arriving at the US border resulted in draconian new policies. This, in turn, drove the Mexican-born New York-based writer Valeria Luiselli, herself an alien at the time, anxiously awaiting an elusive green card, to take on the role of interpreter and translator, helping to steer the children through the immigration courts. Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions, is the result, a meditation structured around the 40 questions asked to the children by lawyers building their case. And the answers spell the difference between being allowed to stay, and if so, on what terms, or being turned away. Luiselli came into the studio to discuss the ongoing crisis, America's role in it, and where she positions herself as a writer. What follows is an excerpt from a longer interview, which you'll find in full in your podcast feed. I began by asking Valeria how the book came about.
I first heard about the crisis in 2014, and I wrote this book about a year later. I wrote it as a result of 1 year, basically, or a bit more than 1 year working in court as an interpreter, translator, screener for children. There was a huge need at that time for people who could translate between English and Spanish, Spanish and English, because as you may know, in the US, everyone speaks Spanish except lawyers and maybe editors. So they're two very monolingual worlds. And so I was among the many, many volunteers that arrived in those months to listen to kids' stories and translate them into English and write them down in order to have something to start with and hopefully find a pro bono lawyer for that child.
How did you, you have a very specific role in all of this. How did you understand your role as a translator and an interpreter, the two things not being the same thing? How did you find, what did you find that you were doing? What was your role? And perhaps you could talk a bit about the importance of language, because you set it very much, the problem, as being one about reframing things with the language that you use.
I mean, court interpreting is an art on its own, and I had no previous formal training as a court interpreter or as a simultaneous interpreter. It really is a very difficult thing to do. And I did have some basic training in translation, but it's also not my area. You know? So I had to learn quickly and a lot. But I think what was clear from the beginning is that there was an overlap of several forms of translation. So there was, first of all, the very literal sense of carrying over what children said in Spanish into English. But then there was also a kind of translation from an adult language, a bureaucratic language, to the language that a child might understand. So often some of the questions in the questionnaire are incomprehensible for a child, such as, did anyone in your former country need and have access to mental health insurance? There's no way to have a conversation. And the point of the interview with an intake interview with a child in court is to really get as much information from a child so that a case can be built, and with that case, a pro bono lawyer found. So it makes no sense to try to follow this very sort of bureaucratic, brutal language. So there's a level of interpreting there, interpreting and translating and rephrasing. And then there's other very just fine layers, complex threads that have to do with sort of cultural translation, if I may say it like that. For example, I'm a Chilanga, which means I'm from Mexico City. A lot of the kids that I interview are catrachos, which means they're from Honduras. And Hondurans are not very fond of Mexicans, and for a good reason, because Mexico is a country that has always treated Hondurans with great cruelty, and much more so in recent immigration waves. A lot of people get killed, disappeared. So there's a kind of difficult negotiation in the terms that I use when I interview a child from Honduras. And I remember one of the first kids I interviewed, and he's someone I talk about in the book. He said, "What are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm not a gringa." And he said, "So what are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm a Chilanga." And he said, "Well, I'm a catracho," which means we're enemies. And I said, "Well, yeah, but we're only enemies in football, and I suck at it, so you've already scored 5 goals against me, so let's get on with this, right?" And he kind of smiled, and he almost laughed, and I didn't gain his trust, but maybe I did at least get his attention. Mm. And he was a teenager, so it was a more difficult kind of interaction. So the whole time I had to negotiate with these very invisible threads that bind us and also separate us, right?
This is Manon you're talking about, I think. Yes. You describe his story as obsessing you through the book, and I guess that's because he, perhaps more than any of the others, really brings home the extent to which the US is implicated in all of this, how symbiotic the relationship is there. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that, his particular story.
Yes, exactly. That's a really good way of putting it. So Manon, whose story I tell in great detail in the book, and who is a person that I'm still in contact with him and his whole family, and partly for bad reasons, basically because his case is ongoing, and although he now has some form of immigration relief, he doesn't have a green card, and it's not clear if he will ever. But he arrived in 2014, and I interviewed him in court at his first notice to appear, in the early months of 2015. So I was his first kind of court screener, right? And he was my first case. He had been basically persecuted by gangs in his home country, in Honduras. He refused to join a gang, despite the great pressure that was put on him. He actually went to the police at some point and filed a report, and nothing was done. And one day he was just getting out of school with his best friend, and he noticed that boys from that gang, not only boys, but sort of older men too from that gang, were waiting for him outside the school, and that there were many, so that there was no chance in fighting them. So he left walking, pretending not to notice, not to see, just not acknowledging their presence. And they started walking after him and his friend. At some point, they took out guns. So Manu and his friend started running. And the gang members shot Manu's best friend right there in front of him as they tried to run away. You know, shot him in the back. And Manu kept on running. He kept on running. And he eventually made it home and safe. And that night he called an aunt that he has in Long Island, who had migrated years earlier, and told her the story. And she said, "Don't worry, I understand this is that your life is at risk. I'm going to get you over here, whatever that costs me." And she did. She paid a coyote to get him over to the U.S. Coyote being a people smuggler, basically, someone who crosses children or adults across national borders. So Coyote took Manu over to the U.S., and Manu turned himself in at the border. The Coyote didn't cross the deserts with him. He just deposited Manu at the U.S. border, and Manu, as most kids, looked for Border Patrol to turn himself in as soon as possible. Often kids, by the way, would tell me in court that the worst would be not to find a policeman, like to get to the desert and then just be in the middle of the desert with no one there, so deposited by a coyote and no policeman in sight. So children usually in groups or sometimes alone walk through the most transited way highways and roads, just waiting for a policeman and border patrol to appear.
Because in effect, until you exist in the system, you don't exist at all.
Right. I mean, not only is crossing the desert, if you're a child on your own, practically impossible, but if you do cross it and actually survive and manage to get to the first town and arrive to a point where there's water and food, you'll be a ghost, basically, because no one caught you, and so you're not in the system, and then your destiny is to remain undocumented for the rest of your life. And that's not what these children want, and that's not what international law dictates, by the way. No? These children, because of the situation they're fleeing, like Manu, fleeing a systematic persecution, not of a government, but of a kind of parastate, which is what gangs have become, right? They have a justice system, they traffic arms, they traffic drugs, they have they almost have their own currency. I mean, they don't, but they are like a parallel economy and a parallel government. So international laws that protect refugees, if someone is persecuted by a group, a political group, or a government for certain kind of reasons, there's four or five very clear categories of what makes you eligible for asylum. But if you're running, if you're being persecuted for any one of those reasons, you are eligible for asylum. So these kids are, by international standards. They just need to find a lawyer to make their case. So when Manu arrived finally in the U.S., safe, he received this notice to appear. I interviewed him in court. And while I was interviewing him, he took out a piece of paper that was this report, report that he'd filed in the police, denouncing the fact that there was this group of men, young men, boys, and older men from a gang that had constantly harassing him. And when I saw that, although I'm not a lawyer, I thought, well, maybe, you know, this looks like some kind of evidence, so let's ask. And I called over the lawyer that had given me the basic training to start interviewing the kids, and she said, "That's it. You don't have to even continue with the interview. this gives us a really solid case. And so Manu luckily received, immediately he got really great pro bono lawyers, basically like huge firm that does some pro bono work, who took on his case because it was a kind of easy case, you know, and a case that would be won. And they did win the case in some ways. He has a type of protection right now called the SIJ visa. It's a special immigrant juvenile status. But what happened beyond the court is that when Manu started going to school, he started being bullied by gangs in his school in Long Island.
Ones that he recognized, ones that effectively connected right back to where he'd come from.
Exactly. There was the MS-13, which had been present in Honduras and he'd been fleeing, and there was Barrio 18, another gang that he'd been fleeing. So he did not know, but it turned out that in Hempstead, Long Island, there were exactly the same gangs that he was trying to flee from in Honduras. So this realization, a lot of kids don't know when they arrive to the U.S. that maybe they're trapped in a kind of nightmare that they cannot wake up from, right? Because the gangs are not—they're not a couple of drug dealers standing in a corner. They're really like. I was talking about kind of parastates, but they're like transnational parastates. They have an immense power. I mean, no one really knows, but the MS-13 has maybe more than 60,000 members. And these, you know, these are people with guns, people with a kind of fearless fearless attitude to life, but also no respect for life, right? Mm. So that's what the U.S. often does not acknowledge.
And how much do you think that there's been a growing awareness, or in fact the opposite, in terms of the general public? I know, of course, that your book is being has been billed as, you know, the first book to read for the Trump era, but, you know, it predates that, because in fact when you start writing, it's about policies that came into effect during the Obama administration. So where are we now? What's the climate? What's changed since President Trump came into power?
I mean, everything is worse, but of course, all these policies started long before Trump existed. I mean, everyone has been somehow complicit, and the Democrats have not been better, at least for immigrant lives, right? Mm. There's maybe more education on the matter now because more people are writing about it in spaces that are more visible, perhaps. So there's more awareness that this particular immigration crisis is not really an immigration crisis, but a refugee crisis, and that the United States is implicated in it historically. I go into why that is in the book, reasons of its implication, and also in the shared responsibility of the governments of the USA, Mexico, and the Northern Triangle. And I argue in the book that until all our governments acknowledge their shared responsibility, there will be no solution either for transnational gangs or their victims, which are children most of the time, children and minors. The Trump situation is not going to make any of this better, because the way that he and the White House manipulate information is, I don't even have to go into that, but for example, Trump was in Long Island a few months ago, and he spoke of the gangs there, the MS-13 and so on, in complete false terms. He said what he usually said: these gangs are pouring into the U.S. from the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's why we need a wall and we have to stop these gangs from coming in. Those gangs were born in L.A., not in Central America. They're not a local problem that is being exported or imported into the U.S. The MS-13 was an L.A. gang, as well as Barrio 18. Many people don't know that, and it's easy to manipulate and hide that fact.
Yeah, and it's such a central part of the story,
yeah,
that you can't ignore that detail. I mean, I suppose it's interesting in that respect as well that I saw that refugee admission has now been capped at an all-time low.
Absolutely, that's what happened now. I mean, I was talking about Manu's particular case earlier, the fact that the last time I spoke to his lawyers, which was not even a week ago, to ask them what the updates were for his renewal of his current immigration status and for his green card, which he applied for more than a year ago. And the answer was the green card is, there's a big backlog and they won't come until further notice, because the answer was there are no more green cards for Central American children that are trying to get an adjustment of status from a refugee status to a resident status. Just, there's simply no more. The latest update from the White House nightmare is that the government wants to, among other things, deport children as soon as they arrive at the Mexico-US border, regardless of their nationality, and not give them due process, not allow them to go through legal proceedings, as is, by the way, what is constitutional and what international and national law dictates. So, I mean, I don't think this will happen, or not immediately, because it would be illegal. But the law has been changed before. That law used to include children from all over the world, and Bush changed it in 2007 to exclude from it children from Mexico and Canada, really de facto.
Countries that share borders with the US.
Exactly. So de jure, Mexico and Canada, but de facto only Mexico. So it's been done before, and they can find a way, and they will certainly find a way to try to exclude children from Central America. But it won't be immediate, because it's, I think, I mean, a lot of lawyers working that have been working on this for a long time, I think, I hope, will find ways to protect as many children, that, especially the ones that are already there and are in an immigration limbo, right?
Like Manuel, yeah. Thank you very much. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Huge pleasure. Thank you very much.
This year is the 150th anniversary of Matthew Arnold's New Poems, in which Dover Beach appeared. Its conclusion is, of course, rather famous. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. So, was Matthew Arnold any good? A provocative question by Seamus Perry, who goes on rather brilliantly to answer it in the TLS this week. He certainly reveals the perhaps surprisingly low regard in which Arnold has been held by many, since Arnold's own time. Keats's editor, Henry Buxton Foreman, said this: "From his poems, taken as a body, it is difficult to imagine how pleasure or profit is to be extracted, for the style is unpoetic in the extreme, and the sense of rhythm and sound faulty to the last degree." And T.S. Eliot quoted Received Wisdom when he complained, "I'm not sure he was highly sensitive to the musical qualities of verse." So what are we to make of Arnold the poet now? We can have no better guide than Seamus Perry, who is on the line with us. Seamus, welcome. Let's talk about Matthew Arnold's reputation as it currently stands and whether it's shifted over time. Because you paint a picture in the piece which almost implies that he's always been slightly looked down upon as a poet. Is that fair?
Yes, well, he has a double reputation, really, because, of course, as well as being a poet, he's a great man of letters and social commentator and political thinker. And I think his reputation in the 20th century is largely the second of those two things. It's the prose Arnold that was important, I think, for lots of the 20th century, very often as someone who people wanted to attack. So he was important enough to need to disagree with. And that's as true of T.S. Eliot as it is of Terry Eagleton. I mean, he always represented a certain kind of literary liberalism that they wanted to attack. As a poet, his reputation is, as you just said, always had this slightly kind of ambiguous quality, in that he was recognised as being an important writer, recognized as being a writer who is important partly because he captured, as it were, the temperature of the age in this extraordinary way, in the way that maybe W.H. Auden does in the 1930s or Philip Larkin does in the 1950s, that sort of zeitgeist kind of voice. But at the same time, lots and lots of his most attentive readers were forced to say things like, you know, he actually wasn't terribly competent. Saintsbury, for example, talks about the incompetences of expression, which are so oddly characteristic of him. So it's a peculiar reputation which interested me, and maybe you want to write something about it.
This is the beginning of one of his sonnets. So we'll talk about a couple of other poems because you quote extensively in the piece. But the beginning of one of his sonnets says, "Who prop thou axed in these bad days my mind?" Yep. I've not read very well, but and virtually everybody. Virtually everybody in the history of literary criticism has nominated this for the worst opening line in the English sonnet.
But that's right.
Do you begin to defend this? Because there's a line you use, which is from Bailey of Keats, saying awkwardness is part of the accuracy. Can you defend a line as seemingly awkward as that?
Well, I think awkward is exactly the right word to choose. And I think what Arnold is trying to do at some level of self-awareness, I'm not saying the entire thing is completely self-conscious, but I think at some level of self-awareness, he's writing a poetry which is emerging out of a time and out of a predicament and out of a set of emotional and human and literary circumstances that he thinks of as being profoundly unpoetic, unliterary. So he writes to his best friend Clough and says that one of the things that characterize modern life, the things that characterize modernity, are blankness and barrenness and unpoetrylessness. And if you keep in mind that Arnold always wants to write a poetry that is in some way true to the age in which he's writing, then in a funny kind of way, he's committed to writing a poetry that is uneasy, a poetry that entertains discordance and dissonance and awkwardness, to use your word. And that, I mean, that is in all sorts of ways a terrible line of poetry. "Who prop thou askest in these bad days my mind?" But at the same time, you know, it is self-evidently a line that's coming out of what he calls himself bad days. The idea of badness, a moral badness, a political, a cultural badness, sort of translates in a rather brilliant way into what in other circumstances we might think of as a poetic or an aesthetic badness. So it's a very risky kind of experiment, and he exposes himself to lots of negative sorts of remarks, which, as I mentioned a moment ago, he's continued to receive ever since. But I think it's something that is quite an intelligent response to the predicament in which he found himself.
You describe his poetry as being for the initiated, perhaps precisely because of that, because you have to work to understand what it's doing.
Yeah.
So it's a poetry for the few rather than the many. What would Arnold have made of that?
I think he'd have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I think there was in Arnold, as there was in all of the great Victorian liberal thinkers, there was a very broad commitment to the democratic tendency of history, that as the franchise expanded, so, as it were, the cultural franchise would also expand, and that was a good thing. At the same time, there was also a tremendous fear, I think, about the consequences of that expansion, and a strong sense you get in all sorts of places in Arnold that perhaps culture is only going to be sustained within quite small, if you like, elite groups. And that's one of the reasons why someone like Terry Eagleton, for example, or other writers on the left dislike Arnold, because they see, along with his liberalism, a kind of commitment to the idea of culture, which actually does commit you to a mass civilization, but a minority culture.
I'm interested in his assertion, "Not deep the poet sees, but wide."
Yeah. I mean,
does that constitute a slight difference to how other poets would have been positioning themselves, do you think? It gave me pause for thought somehow.
Well, yes, that's interesting. I think what he's trying to get at when he says that sort of thing is to define himself against, let's say, for example, a Tennyson sort of lyricism, which is a kind of an introspective and inward, you know, "Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean, tears in the depths of some divine despair," which comes out of a kind of romanticism, a kind of Byronic or perhaps Wordsworthian romanticism. And I think what Arnold is always trying to do is to bring into his poetry the idea of other sorts of perspectives, or the broad, the wide, the European view that escapes merely the literature of a point of view. One of the things that defines him as modern, I think, Henry James famously says he is the poet of our modernity, and one of the things that defines him as modern is this idea that truth has become individualized. You no longer ask, "Is it true? Is it so?" The modern question, Arnold says in one of his essays, is "Is it so to me?" Ooh. So in one sense, that's a privatization of the truth.
Yeah.
But in another way, everyone else can say the same thing as well.
So it's democratic.
Well, absolutely. And it also means that poetry needs to, if it's going to be true to the spirit of the age, poetry needs to kind of somehow weave into its own textures the idea of other sorts of reality or other kinds of perspective or other kinds of point of view. And I think that's what he means by seeing wide. It's seeing not just out, you know, within the terms of your own perception, but the possibility of other kinds of history or other kinds of tradition or other kinds of position.
Should we return to some of the poetry? I'm interested in him as a technician, because there's an argument he's a poor rhymer. And you quote a bit, I don't know if you've got it in front of you, I've got it if you haven't, from Isolation, which he uses as an illustration of how his rhymes were rich even when they weren't successful.
Right.
Have you got that there? I can read it out if not. The bit you quote this bit from Isolation. Shall I read it?
Yes, do.
Yet she, chaste queen, had never proved how vain a thing is mortal love, wandering in heaven far removed, but thou hast long had place to prove this truth, to prove and make thine own, thou hast been, shalt be, art alone.
Yes.
And I guess you sense these rhymes sound like they resolve things, but they don't quite. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's a tremendous self-consciousness about the literary tradition within which this poem sits, which is the tradition of love poetry. And Arnold, as a love poet, is a very ambiguous creature, because his love poems are often about relationships that don't seem to connect, and they're almost non-love poems. All of his love poems are like that. And this is a great example. What he's talking about here is the myth of Endymion, who is a beautiful youth with whom the moon falls in love. And, you know, obviously that's about as far away from a successful human relationship as you can imagine. And as though playing on that idea of connections, human connections, love connections that don't actually connect, he does really brilliant things, it seems to me, with rhymes and non-rhymes, with the word love. Love is this nightmare rhyme word in English, which forces you to think about skies above and doves and stuff like that. Here he's doing off rhymes, para rhymes between love and prove, which is interesting. But then he complicates that even more by having proved as another rhyme word along with removed within the same stanza. So there's a real kind of tangle of rhymes that are perhaps sight rhymes but not real acoustic rhymes. Proved, love, removed, prove. I mean, this is in some senses incompetent rhyming, because it confuses and complicates what should be a legible rhyme scheme in the hands of a more obviously accomplished poet, like, let's say, Tennyson or something like that. But it seems to me within the dramatic context of the lyric, which is that this is a poem all about the extraordinarily difficulty of proving love, then getting all these lines, these rhymes mixed up in this way is actually brilliant. And to end with the rhyme "thine own" and "alone" also has a brilliant sense, it seems to me, of appearing to resolve all that rather awkward acoustic tangle of the partial rhymes that we've had before, but also to resolve nothing really, because "own" as a rhyme is wholly contained within "alone." So it's not really a good rhyme at all. It's a kind of imperfect or incomplete or you know, it's like a rough stab at a rhyme or an imperfect gesture towards a rhyme, rather than the kind of concluding triumphant kind of couplet that you might get at the end of a Shakespeare sonnet.
We've got another example of this. Now I'm going to play devil's advocate in a moment, Seamus. But in the poem Growing Old, you talk about the avoidance of the old music of poetry with a sort of desolate scrupulosity, the idea that if rhymes are too clean and pat, that'd be a terrible way of describing the sort of sagging entropy of age. And let me, I'll quote a bit and you can expand on that. This is from Growing Old. It is to suffer this and feel but half and feebly what we feel. Deep in our hidden hearts festers the dull remembrance of a change, but no emotion, none.
Yeah.
And your argument, I believe, is that there's little hints of half rhyme there to illustrate the fact that he could rhyme if he wanted to, but he's really trying to demonstrate that that would be an inappropriate way of exploring old age.
Yes, I think that's right. The important thing about this is it's a lyric, so it's actually set out in stanzas. So unrhymed poetry, that's not an unusual thing for the Victorians. I mean, Tennyson writes vast amounts of unrhymed poetry. It's called blank verse. They're used to unrhymed poetry in that sense. And they're even used, if they're really avant-garde, to free verse. You know, they might read bits of Blake or they might read Whitman or something like that.
Yeah.
But this is different. This is actually set out in verses. So it has all the formal characteristics of something that should be rhyming. And as it were, within the Victorian ear, as it were, cued by that visual prompt, that's what you'd be looking for. So Swinburne says, for example, an unrhymed lyric, says Swinburne, is a maimed thing. You know, if you're going to write a lyric, something that's in verses, then it should rhyme. Otherwise, what you're writing is a maimed version of what you should be doing. And it seems to me that's exactly what Arnold is doing here. And the maiming here is the normal aging process that you know withers you and attenuates your powers. But you're right. There is that great line, and feel but half and feebly what we feel. It's a great line in its own terms, but obviously part of the greatness of that line is the fact that it's got something to do with the internal rhymes in that line. And feel, the first two words, and we feel, the last two words. So there's a kind of internal rhyme thing going on there. And then in the middle, feebly, which is obviously a sort of rhyme with both feel at the beginning of the line and feel at the end of the line. So, but only a feeble one, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So there's something kind of quite ingenious, it seems to me, about the way he's doing something with the consonants of sound, but he's not doing it at the line endings where, as it were, a more confident or, let's say, a younger man's poem would do it.
So here's the devil's advocate argument,
yes.
Seamus, is that you love Arnold, and therefore every time you see maladroitness, as you put it, you find a good litquit poetic reason for it. You don't see stumbling, you see a kind of mimetic ballet in the poetry, and therefore you're looking to defend him because you value him, even when he may be nodding, as it were.
Well, that's a very good point, and your advocacy for the devil is extremely good. Of course, yes, of course, I'm absolutely open to that. I'd say a couple of things. One is that for my TLS piece, of course, I've only chosen the very best examples, and there are some examples which, you know, just aren't terribly interesting. And I think that I've chosen examples where questions of, let's say, feebleness or inadequacy or stumbling or waywardness or errancy or things like that are actually what the poetry is talking about. So there's some kind of connection between the formal adventure that the poetry is doing and actually the subject that if you were to put it into, paraphrase it into prose, the poem would be about. Another thing I'd say is that we know from reading Arnold's prose that he's really interested in the whole idea of error, the whole idea of mistakes and getting things wrong. He writes a series of books in the 1870s about the Bible, and he's trying to communicate to the Victorian literate public the latest advances in biblical scholarship, which are mostly being prosecuted in Germany, being pursued in Germany. And one of the things he says in that is that the Bible is not a perfect text. The Bible is not a text without error. If you're going into your chapel and you're being told by your preacher that the Bible is infallible, then they're wrong. The Bible is shot through with fallibility. John's Gospel, he says in one of his books of that period, is actually in some senses a very incompetently written work. There are all sorts of things in it that if you were a decent writer, you wouldn't have done. But the turn in his argument is to say, and that's what legitimates it. That's what makes it humanly interesting. That's what actually gives it, you know, persuasiveness and emotional power, and a kind of spiritual authority. That this is someone who's struggling with stuff that they really can't understand because human language struggles so much to cope with ideas of divinity and spirituality and all the rest of it. Now, he never actually explicitly applies all that to his own practice, and he wouldn't have compared himself to St. John, needless to say. But there's a similar kind of interest, it seems to me, in the resources of what might look like an error to actually communicate something which is a kind of a truth. And one of the great things about rhyme, once you've committed yourself to writing within a rhyme culture, which perhaps we don't have anymore because so much poetry doesn't rhyme normally anyway, but within a poetic culture in which rhyme is a norm, then the decision to rhyme imperfectly or to rhyme not at all can, I think, and I would say this is true of Arnold in many cases, can be weighted and freighted with a tremendous kind of meaning and significance.
Seamus, you've convinced me utterly of that. Thank you so much for going through this and joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I just love a bit of Pratt crit.
Yeah.
It's just so great because, I mean, I do buy that argument entirely, I think. But I just love it when you have someone like him, you can go through a poem and you read it yourself and your brain slightly goes blank and then someone points out things.
Yeah. And he does that beautifully in this piece, and he raises so many points that aren't even necessarily ones that you can only apply to Arnold specifically.
I'm sure that's right.
So what he was just talking about, the difference between something divine and human, for example, it reminds me of what Leslie Stephen said of Arnold, and Seamus quotes it. He says, Leslie Stephen, Virginia Woolf's dad, of course, described Arnold as one of the poets who are made, not born. So you've got from the very beginning this
which is a total
this
cuss.
Kind of hierarchy, exactly, yeah. This hierarchy between the poet who was born a poet and who's somehow better, truer,
yeah.
Than the, you know, the diligent, self-made craftsman,
yeah.
You know.
So it comes back to class.
So interesting.
It comes back to class, like all these
it
things
does.
In
and,
that period.
And funnily enough, the whole piece makes me think of what people said all the time and only now sort of stop saying is what they say about D.H. Lawrence, which was that his prose was, you know, clumsy and he would repeat the same words and it was rough and you know, it just wasn't divine. It wasn't pure or yeah. Whatever it was, but this is exactly the same thing.
Because he's from the Midlands. I know, I feel his pain. And actually, funny enough, Seamus Perry, last time we spoke to him on this podcast was about
exactly
D.H. Lawrence. So people, if they haven't heard that, should go and check that out.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you are transgender and if you come out as an adult in a position of authority, a tenured professor say, non-trans people may treat you as an expert. So begins the piece this week by tenured professor Stephanie Burt, who has reviewed two books that discuss being a trans person, Trans Like Me by C.N. Lester and The Gender Games by Juno Dawson. Both may help teach the world Trans 101, provide information to non-trans people, also known as cis, and perhaps solace to trans people themselves who are looking for community and literature that speaks to them and is by them. To consider the importance of that, we are joined by Stephanie Burt on the line from Massachusetts. Stephanie, welcome. This is a very personal review, which is why it's so lovely. How did you feel reading these books, getting sent these books and taking a look at them?
Whenever one writes about anything that's, you know, important, it's personal. If you're someone who studies the surface of Mars, and I'm teaching a book about the surface of Mars later today, then your description of the Martian surface can be personal. But the C.N. Lester book, Trans Like Me, is very explanatory and clear and compact, and it honestly feels like they had a short word count, because the book is designed to make clear to anyone who, you know, reads adult-level books about anything, not necessarily academic books or books written in challenging styles, designed to make clear things you need to know to be an informed community member and things you need to know if there are or there might be trans people in your life, which, of course, means everyone, because even if you don't think you know any trans people, you probably do. They're just not out to you, and they may not want to be out to anyone. They may be stealth.
Is this a book that exposes myths and misunderstandings?
The most important one, because previous books of this kind did not do that. C.N. Lester is non-binary. C.N. Lester is someone who doesn't feel like a man or a woman, someone who just does not fit into the existing framework, because the framework that most of us grew up with about gender is quite binary. People who are not men are women. People who are not women are men. And it's as if you had grown up in a world where everyone was either, let's say, a scientist or a painter.
Yeah.
And then you met someone who was a professional musician, and they defined their life by playing music, and said, well, you have to be a scientist or a painter. If you don't work in a lab with Bunsen burners, then you must work with oil paints. And they said, no, that's not who I am. I would like you to understand who I am and what gives my life meaning. And that seems to be how C.N. Lester experiences being non-binary, and I have friends who would describe it that way. I know other people, both quite young people and grown-ups, who are quite confidently non-binary in another way, which is that they're not neither nor, they're both and. They're a boy and a girl, they're a man and a woman, they present in radically different ways on different days, and want that multiplicity of identity recognized rather than being told you got to be one thing or the other all the time. That's experienced as confining and as repressive. So that's also a way of being non-binary. So C.N. Lester is doing the relatively new and important work of explaining non-binary identity to people who don't understand it or haven't sort of encountered it before.
Or maybe are a bit nervous about it. And maybe are a bit nervous about it because they feel they don't understand it.
And who may be nervous about it, yeah. And one of the things, there's a positive feedback loop here, because the more cis people understand, cis people or cisgender people, people who are comfortable in the binary gender that most of us were assigned at birth, the more cis people understand and welcome trans and other kinds of gender nonconforming identities, the more those of us who are trans and who don't fit into the gender box we were put in quite early in life, the more those of us who are trans can be ourselves, and the better everyone's lives are.
Yeah.
So that means that besides explaining their own non-binariness, Lester does some kinds of work that are very familiar to me because other writers have done this, and sometimes I have to do this. But it's work that's not over yet, explaining, do ask us what our preferred pronouns are. Don't ask us anything about our body parts that you would not ask a cisgender person. Don't ask strangers about medical procedures.
Yeah.
We've been around for a long time in one sense, because there are gender nonconforming people in every society, and third gender roles that are recognized and respected in many. But in another sense, this is new because the social changes and the medical procedures that allow those of us sort of raised in Western-shaped high-tech societies to be ourselves.
You mentioned pronouns. Do you think, because one of the things I think fascinates me, and we'll get to the other book also, is the extent to which language matters here.
Mm-hmm.
How important are correct use of pronouns, do you think? Is that an important step?
It is quite important. It involves recognizing us as who we are, and it involves not misrecognizing us as who we're not. Your name is Stig. People who have any first name basis with you call you Stig. And it would be disconcerting and distracting and perhaps distressing to you if people routinely called you by names that are not yours.
Yep.
Or seem to recognize you as someone you don't want to be. A very familiar form of this is grade school teasing, where children call other children by names they don't want and that are demeaning or inappropriate. Because we happen to be speaking a language, English, where singular third-person pronouns and some titles of respect are clearly gendered. People are sir or ma'am or miss. People are he or she. Being called the wrong pronoun or addressed with the wrong gendered title of respect is distressing. And it's actually more important to me, and this is me, this isn't like all trans people everywhere, when strangers or people I've just met use the wrong pronoun or the wrong title of respect, that is intensely distressing because it means they're looking at me and they're not seeing a woman. When people I've known for 20 years use the wrong pronoun, I don't mind that much because once you get an English pronoun attached to a name in your head, if you think in English, it requires a good deal of effort to change this. One way to fix this would be for everyone to communicate in Persian, a language that has a wonderful poetic tradition and no genders for anything. I believe they have really? Other kinds of noun declensions, like accusatives and nominatives, like yeah. Latin and Greek, but I think that Persian has no gender for anything except personal names. Would be great, but you know, we're not communicating.
Do we need a new pronoun? Because I actually find that the use of they, them, I totally understand it, but because your brain goes plural, it makes sentences sometimes, and this is not the end of the world, because it's just if a sentence is slightly hard to read, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, so I felt that way, you know, 6 years ago when I first realized that I really needed to come out and to be myself, that they was a little disconcerting and awkward. And I've learned a couple of things, partly through experience and partly through listening to professional linguists and people who do historical linguistics. One is that they is something that you get used to, just like people got used to Ms. in the 70s. One is that the evidence of other ways that the language has changed, that spoken English has changed, suggests that it's almost always easier and less disconcerting over one generation to repurpose an existing word than to introduce a brand new word. Uh-huh. And the third thing I've learned is that all the actual candidates for brand new words are bad. If you know someone where it's really important to them that you address them as Z or E or D or any of the other proposed pronouns, if that's important to your friends, then call them Z. But there, I think those coinages are going to turn out to be harder to popularize than singular they. And each of those coinages has its own problems that have to do with the many different kinds of English. Because if I start calling people Z, it sounds like you're speaking comic book French. Yeah. And I know Americans who would like it to be E. E and ers. And of course, that just sounds like a bad Cockney accent.
Yeah.
So this is why I've become a strong partisan of singular they. But it is disconcerting when you start using it, and I've actually had that experience too.
And how is the media, or how is the publishing industry specifically, how is that getting on? What kind of big changes have you seen? What still needs to happen? You do point out that there is a big difference between books, of course, that are written by trans people and those that are written for trans people.
Different sectors of publishing in the US and in Britain and in New Zealand, the only other country where I know something about the publishing, are responding in different ways, in different paces. All of them are moving in the right direction from what I can see, but there are different degrees of pushback and there are different speeds of motion. The sectors that are changing the fastest and in the most exciting ways, and they're sectors that I'm close to, are the world of poetry, at least in North America, in the U.S. and Canada, and the science fiction world, which at this point, and I teach a course on this, the science fiction world is uniquely appropriate for people where, you know, history and the categories we already have and realism do not do justice to our experience, where we need things to change and to imagine new ways of being in order to feel comfortable and in the world that we have, because science fiction at its best is there for new kinds of language. And the poetry world, again, at least in North America, if you're in the right parts of it, has been quite welcoming.
Stephen, well, it's a real joy talking to you, and it's a lovely piece, and it's nice to, and it is optimistic. I think let's be optimistic is the tone to strike. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Stephanie Burt, Valeria Luiselli. Am I getting
that's
any better
perfect.
At that?
Perfect. No, yeah. That's brilliant.
Oh, I should have just kept on going. I should have kept on going. And Seamus Perry. Do go to the-tls.co.uk or your local shop for this week's edition of the paper, which has an art history theme. Female Bohemians, Edward Lear, Hercules Sagers, the Dutch painter we've all heard of. Thea, had you heard of Hercules Sagers?
Of course.
Yep, I believe you. And Jonathan Meads is also spouting off about the art world very entertainingly. Next week, we enter the world of learned journals. And also, or just journals, we're calling them
learned,
now.
Learned, with an accent on the E.
Would you say learned? You can't say learned.
No, it's just funny seeing it written.
No, learned journals. But we don't call it... Lucy
just
said she doesn't want to call it learned
journals. We've had magazines,
Yeah. It's just interesting books, like exactly. Interior design and English literature and stuff like that. We're talking about that, and also punk Americans. Kathy
Acker and Lou Harrison. So God knows what we'll be doing on this podcast. We'll work it out shortly. But do join us to find out. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.